This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of One Crazy Summer by Rita Williams Garcia, narrated by C.C. Aisha Johnson.
Cassius Clay Clouds. Good thing the plane had seat belts and we'd been strapped in tight before takeoff. Without them, that last jolt would have been enough to throw Vonetta into orbit and Fern across the aisle. Still, I anchored myself and my sisters best as I could to brace us for whatever came next. Those clouds weren't through with us yet and dealt another Cassius Clay left and right jab to the body of our Boeing 727. Vonetta shrieked, then stuck her thumb in her mouth. Fern bit down on Miss Patty Cake's pink plastic arm. I kept my whimper to myself. It was bad enough my inside squeezed in and stretched out like a monkey grinder's accordion. No need to let anyone know how frightened I was. I took a breath so when my mouth finally opened, I'd sound like myself and not like some scared rabbit. "It's just the clouds bumping," I told my sisters. "Like they bumped over Detroit and Chicago and Denver." Vonetta pulled her thumb out of her mouth and put her head in her lap. Fern held on to Miss Patty Cake. They listened to me. "We push our way up in the clouds. The clouds get mad and push back. Like you and Fern fighting over red and gold crowns." I didn't know about clouds fighting and pushing for a fact, but I had to tell my sister something. As long as Vonetta kept her fear to one shriek and Fern kept hers to biting Miss Patty Cake, I kept on spinning straw, making everything all right. That's mainly what I do. Keep Vonetta and Fern in line. The last thing Pa and Big Ma wanted to hear was how we made a grand Negro spectacle of ourselves 30,000 feet up in the air around all these white people. "You know how Papa is," I told them. "No way he'd put us on a plane if it were dangerous." They halfway believed me. Just as I had that soft plastic arm out of Fern's mouth, those Cassius Clay fighting clouds threw our 727 another jab. Big Ma, that's Pa's mother, still says Cassius Clay. Pa says Muhammad Ali or just Ali. I slide back and forth from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, whatever picture comes to mind. With Cassius Clay, you hear the clash of fists, like the plane getting jabbed and punched. With Muhammad Ali, you see a mighty mountain greater than Everest, and can't no one knock down a mountain. All the way to the airport, Pa had tried to act like he was dropping off 3 sacks of wash at the laundromat. I'd seen through Pa. He's no Vonetta putting on performances. He has only one or two faces, nothing hidden, nothing exaggerated. Even though it had been his idea that we fly out to Oakland to see Cecile, Pa'd never once said how exciting our trip would be. He just said that seeing Cecile was something whose time had come, that it had to be done. Just because he decided it was time for us to see her didn't mean he wanted us to go. My sisters and I had stayed up practically all night California dreaming about what seemed like the other side of the world. We saw ourselves riding wild waves on surfboards, picking oranges and apples off fruit trees, filling our autograph books with signatures from movie stars we'd seen in soda shops. Even better, we saw ourselves going to Disneyland. We had watched airplanes lift up and fly off into blue sky as we neared the airport. Every time another airliner flew overhead, leaving a trail of white and gray smoke, Big Ma fanned herself and asked, "Jesus, why?" Big Ma had kept quiet long enough. Once inside the terminal, she let it all hang out. She told Pa, "I don't mind saying it, but this isn't right. Coming out to Idlewild and putting these girls on a plane so Cecile can see what she left behind. If she wants to see, let her get on an airplane and fly out to New York." Big Ma doesn't care if President Kennedy's face is on the half dollar or if the airport is now officially named after him. She calls the airport by its old name, Idlewild. Don't get me wrong. Big Mal was as mad and sad as anyone when they killed the president. It's change she has no pity on. However things are stamped in Big Ma's mind is how they will be now and forever. Ida Wild will never be JFK. Cassius Clay will never be Muhammad Ali. Cecile will never be anything other than Cecile. I can't say I blame Big Ma for feeling the way she did. I certainly didn't forgive Cecile. When Cecile left, Fern wasn't on the bottle. Vonetta could walk, but wanted to be picked up. I was 4, going on 5. Pa wasn't sick, but he wasn't doing well either. That was when Big Ma came up from Alabama to see about us. Even though Big Ma read her scripture daily, she hadn't considered forgiveness where Cecile was concerned. Cecile wasn't what the Bible meant when it spoke of love and forgiveness. Only judgment. And believe me, Big Ma had plenty of judgment for Cecile. So even if Cecile showed up on Papa's welcome mat, Big Ma wouldn't swing the front door open. That was why Pa had put us on a plane to Oakland. Either Cecile wouldn't come back to Brooklyn, or she wasn't welcome. Honestly, I don't think Pa could choose between Big Ma and Cecile even after Cecile left him. And us. Even after Cecile proved Big Ma right.
How can you send them to Oakland? Oakland's nothing but a boiling pot of trouble cooking. All them riots.
Pa has a respectful way of ignoring Big Ma. I wanted to smile. He's good at it. A shrill voice had announced the departing flight to Oakland. All three of us had butterflies. Our first airplane ride. Way up above Brooklyn. Above New York. Above the world. Although I could at least keep still, Vonetta and Fern stamped their feet like holy rollers at a revival meeting. Big Ma had grabbed them by the first scruff of fabric she could get a hold of, bent down, and told them to act right. There weren't too many of us in the waiting area, and too many of them were staring. I'd taken a quick count out of habit. Vonetta, Fern, and I were the only Negro children. There were 2 soldier boys in green uniforms who didn't look any older than Uncle Darnell, high school cap and gown one day, army boots and basic training 4 days later. 2 teenage girls with afros. Maybe they were college students. And 1 lady dressed like Jackie Kennedy, carrying a small oval suitcase. Big Ma had also scouted around the waiting room. I knew she worried that we'd be mistreated in some way and sought out a grown brown face to look out for us. Big Ma turned her nose up at the college girls with afros in favor of the Negro lady in the square sunglasses and snappy suit toting the equally snappy oval bag. Big Ma made eye contact with her. When we lined up, she told the Negro Jackie Kennedy,
"These my grandbabies. You look out for them, you hear?"
The snappy Negro lady had been nice enough to smile but hadn't returned the look that Big Ma expected. And Big Ma had expected the look Negro people silently pass each other. She'd expected the stranger to say, as if she were a neighbor, "They're as good as my own. I'll make sure they don't misbehave or be an embarrassment to the Negro race." A blank movie star smile had been all she passed to Big Ma. That lady had only been looking out for her plane seat. Papa had already given me a paper with a phone number to our house, which I knew by heart, and the phone number to his job. He had already told me that his job number was for emergencies only and not for how you doing chats. Last night he had also given me an envelope with $200 in $10 and $20 bills to put in my suitcase. Instead, I folded the bills and stuffed them in my tennis shoe before we left Herkimer Street. Walking on that mound of money felt weird at first, but at least I knew the money was safe. Papa had kissed Vonetta and Fern and told me to look after my sisters. Even though looking after them would have been nothing new, I kissed him and said, "I will, Papa." When the line to the ticket taker had begun to move, Big Ma had gotten teary and mushed us up in her loose-fitting violet and green muumuu dress.
Better come on and get some lovin' now.
She hadn't had to finish the rest about how this might be the last time in a long while for kissing and hugging. A flash of memory told me Cecile wasn't one for kissing and hugging. I had a lot of those memories clicking before me like projector slides in the dark. Lots of pictures, smells, and sounds flashing in and out. Mostly about Cecile, all going way, way back. What I didn't remember clearly, Uncle Darnell always filled in. At least Uncle Darnell remembers Cecile kindly. Golden Gate Bridge. I glanced at my Timex. Among the three of us, I was the only one responsible enough to keep and wear a wristwatch. Vonetta let a girl see hers and never got it back. Fern was still learning to tell time, so I kept hers in my drawer until she was ready to wear it. 6.5 hours had passed since we'd hugged Big Ma and kissed Pa at John F. Kennedy Airport. The clouds had made peace with our Boeing 727. It was safe to breathe. I stretched as far as my legs could go. With these long legs, I'm taken for 12 or 13, even a little older. No one ever guesses 11 going on 12 on their first try. More than my long legs, I'm sure it's my plain face that throws them off. Not plain as in homely plain, but even plain. Steady. I'm not 9 or 7 and given to squealing or oohing like Vonetta and Fern. I just let my plain face and plain words speak for me. That way, no one ever says, huh, to me. They know exactly what I mean. We were long gone from thick white clouds, the plane steadily climbing down. The intercom crackled and the pilot made an announcement about the descent and altitude and that we would be landing in 10 minutes. I let all that pass by until he said, "And to your left as we circle the bay is the Golden Gate Bridge." I was now a liar, a stone-faced liar. I wanted to squeal and ooh like a 7-year-old meeting Tinkerbell. I had read about the Golden Gate Bridge in class, the California gold rush, the Chinese immigrants building the railroads connecting east to west. It wasn't every day you saw a live picture of what you read about in your textbook. I wanted to look down from above the world and see the Golden Gate Bridge. Being stuck in the middle seat, I was mad at myself. Of the three of us, I was the first to board the 727. Why hadn't I taken the window seat when I had my chance? Instead of the squeal I knew wouldn't come out of me in the first place, I sighed. No use crying about it now. The truth was, one pout from either Vonetta or Fern, and I would have given up the window seat. This was the only way it could be. Vonetta and Fern on either side, and me in between them. 6.5 hours was too long a time to have Vonetta and Fern strapped side by side, picking at each other. We would have been the grand Negro spectacle that Big Ma had scolded us against becoming when we were back in Brooklyn. Still, the Golden Gate Bridge was getting away from me. I figured at least one of us should see it, and that should be the one who read about it in class. "Look, Vonetta, look down at the bridge." Vonetta stayed tight to her stubborn curl, her chin in her lap. "I'm not looking." I turned to my right and got a mouthful of hair and barrettes. Fern had leaned over from her aisle seat. "I want to see. Make a switch." To Fern, the Golden Gate Bridge sounded like Sleeping Beauty's castle. She halfway believed in things not true and didn't know where fairy tales ended. No use spoiling it for her. She'd figure things out soon enough. Fern was wriggling out of her seatbelt and climbing on me to get a glimpse. This was how it was at home. Why should 1,000 feet up in the air make any difference? "Sit back, Fern," I said in my plain, firm voice. "We're getting ready to land." She pouted, but sat back down. I tightened her seatbelt. Vonetta's face stayed in her lap. That was just pitiful. "Go look down, Vonetta," I said, "before you miss it." Vonetta refused to pry her chin from her lap. She stuck her thumb back in her mouth and closed her eyes. I wasn't worried about Vonetta. Once we got on the ground, she'd be her showy self again, and this Fraidy Cat episode would be long faded. As we continued to circle the bay above the Golden Gate Bridge, I felt like I was being teased for the simple act of wanting. Each time the plane curved around, I knew in my heart it would be my last chance, and the bridge was singing, "Na, na, 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 you can't see me." Now I had to see the bridge. How many times would I be this high up and have a sight as spectacular as the Golden Gate Bridge right underneath me? I loosened my seatbelt, lifted myself, and leaned over Vonetta's head and shoulders to get a look out of the oval window. I pressed against Vonetta, just a little, not enough to cause a stir. But Vonetta and Fern, who was now angry, both hollered, "Delphine!" as loud as they could. Heads turned our way. A stewardess rushed to our row. "Sit in your seat, Missy," she scolded me. "We're getting ready to land." Even though there were only 8 Negroes on board, counting my sisters and me, I had managed to disgrace the entire Negro race, judging by the head-shaking and tisk-tisking going on around us. I shifted my behind into my seat and tightened my seatbelt. But not before I had seen orange steel poking through thick ground clouds below. Smog. There was no time to savor my victory or feel my shame. The plane went roaring down farther and farther. Vonetta held onto my left arm, and Fern, with Miss Pattycake, grabbed my right. I dug into the armrests and prayed the pilot had done this before. The plane bounced off the ground as soon as we hit land. It kept bouncing and surging forward until the bouncing smoothed out and we were rolling against the ground, nice and steady. I took a deep breath so I'd sound like myself when I started telling Vonetta and Fern what to do. The main thing was we were on the ground. We were in Oakland. Secret Agent Mother. The Negro lady with the snappy oval bag didn't give us a glance as she click-clacked on by. That was fine with me, although I'd tell Big Ma otherwise if she asked, just to keep her from worrying. And I'd make it short and simple. I only get caught if I try to spin too much straw. With both feet safely on the ground, Vonetta became her old self, her face shining and searching. "What do we call her?" I'd gone over this with Vonetta and Fern many, many times. I told them long before Papa said we were going to meet her. I told them while we packed our suitcases. "Her name is Cecile. That's what you call her. When people ask who she is, you say, 'She's our mother.'" Mother is a statement of fact. Cecile Johnson gave birth to us. We came out of Cecile Johnson. In the animal kingdom, that makes her our mother. Every mammal on the planet has a mother, dead or alive. Ran off or stayed put. Cecile Johnson, mammal birth giver, alive, and abandoner, is our mother. A statement of fact. Even in the song we sing when we miss having a mother, and not her, but a mother, period, we sing about a mother. "Mother's gotta go now, la, 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 la. Never mommy, mom, Mama or Ma. Mommy gets up to give you a glass of water in the middle of the night. Mom invites your friends inside when it's raining. Mama burns your ears with a hot comb to make your hair look pretty for class picture day. Ma is sore and worn out from wringing your wet clothes and hanging them to dry. Ma needs peace and quiet at the end of the day. We don't have one of those. We have a statement of fact." Vonetta, Fern, and I stood next to the young red-headed stewardess assigned to watch us until Cecile came forward. The stewardess reread the slip of paper in her hand, then eyed the big clock mounted by the arrival and departure board as if she had someplace else to be. She could have left me alone with my sisters. I certainly didn't need her. A man in navy overalls swept garbage off the floor a few feet away from us. He went about his job with no expression, sweeping cigarette packs and gum wrappers into a dustpan that he emptied into a larger trash can. If I were him, picking up after people who carelessly drop stuff on the ground, I'd be nothing but angry. They call it littering when you carelessly drop things. They call the careless folks who drop things by a cute name. Litterbug. There's nothing cute about dropping things carelessly. Dropping garbage and having puppies shouldn't be called the same thing. Litter. I had a mind to write to Miss Webster about that. Puppies don't deserve to be called a litter like they'd been dropped carelessly like garbage. And people who litter shouldn't be given a cute name for what they do. And at least the mother of a litter sticks around and nurses her pups, no matter how sharp their teeth are. Merriam-Webster was falling down on the job. How could she have gotten this wrong? Manetta asked me again, not because she was anxious to meet Cecile. Vonetta asked again so she could have her routine rehearsed in her head. Her curtsy, smile, and greeting leaving Fern and me to stand around like dumb dodos. She was practicing her role as the cute, bouncy pup in the litter and asked yet again, "Delphine, what do we call her?" A large white woman came and stood before us, clapping her hands like we were on display at the Bronx Zoo.
"Oh my, what adorable dolls you are, my, my."
She warbled like an opera singer. Her face was moon full and jelly soft, the cheeks and jaw framed by white whiskers. We said nothing.
"And so well behaved."
Vonetta perked up to out-pretty and out-behave us. I did as Big Ma had told me in our many talks on how to act around white people. I said, "Thank you." But I didn't add the ma'am for the whole "thank you, ma'am." I'd never heard anyone else say it in Brooklyn, only in old movies on TV. And when we drove down to Alabama, people say "yes, ma'am" and "no, ma'am" in Alabama all the time. That old word was perfectly fine for Big Ma. It just wasn't perfectly fine for me. The lady opened her pocketbook, took out a red leather change purse, and scooted coins around searching for the right amount for adorable, well-behaved colored dolls. Big Ma would have thought that was grand, but Papa wouldn't have liked it 1 cent. Now it was time to do what Papa had told me, see after my sisters. We're not allowed to take money from strangers. I said this polite enough to suit Big Ma, but strong enough to suit Papa. The red-headed stewardess was appalled by my uppity behavior.
"Don't you know when someone is being nice to you?"
I put on my dumb dodo face to fake not knowing what she meant. What was the sense of making the stewardess stand guard over us if she refused to protect us from strangers? She thought it was all right to have the large white woman gawk at us, talk to us, and buy our attention. We might as well have stood by ourselves. I didn't have to shift my eyes to see mile-long pouts on Vonetta and Fern. I didn't care. We weren't taking nothing from no strangers. The lady was all smiles and squeals. Her face shook with laughter.
"Oh, and so cute."
She put all the nickels in Fern's hand and pinched her cheek faster than I could do anything about it and was gone, as big as she was. Vonetta grabbed Fern's hand, forced it open, and took her nickel, leaving our 2 coins in Fern's palm. No use telling them to hand the money over. They were already dreaming of penny candy. I let them keep their nickels and mine. The stewardess re-examined the slip of paper. She shifted from one leg to the other. Both my sisters and me and her high heels were bothering her. I looked around the crowd of people pacing and waiting. Papa didn't keep any pictures of Cecile, but I had a sense of her. Fuzzy flashes of her always came and went. But I knew she was big, as in tall, and Hershey-colored like me. I knew I at least had that right. Then something made me look over to my left at a figure standing by the cigarette machine. She moved, then moved back, maybe deciding whether to come to us or not. I told the stewardess before the figure could slip out of the airport. That's her. Fern and Vonetta were excited and scared. They squeezed my hands tight. I could see any thoughts Vonetta had about reciting poetry, tap dancing, and curtsying vanished. She squeezed my hand harder than Fern did. The stewardess marched us on over to this figure. Once we were there, face to face, the stewardess stopped in her tracks and made herself a barrier between the strange woman and us. The same stewardess who let the large white woman gawk at us and press money into Fern's hand wasn't so quick to hand us over to the woman I said was our mother. I wanted to be mad, but I couldn't say I blamed her entirely. It could have been the way the woman was dressed. Big black shades, scarf tied round her head. Over the scarf, a big hat tilted down, the kind Pa wore with a suit. A pair of man's pants. Fern clung to me. Cecile looked more like a secret agent than a mother. But I knew she was Cecile. I knew she was our mother. "Are you?" The stewardess unfurled the crumpled slip of paper. "Cecile Johnson?" She paused heavily between the first and last names. "Are you these colored girls, Mama?" Cecile looked at us, then at the stewardess. "I'm Cecile Johnson. These," she motioned to us, "are mine." That was all the stewardess needed to hear. She dropped the slip of paper on the floor, handed us over, and fled away on her wobbly high heels. Cecile didn't bother to grab any of our bags. She said, "Come on." Took two wide steps and we came. The gap between Cecile and us spread wider and wider. Vonetta sped up but was annoyed that she had to. Fern could only go so fast with her bag in one hand and Miss Patty Cake in the other. And I wasn't going anywhere without Vonetta or Fern, so I slowed down. Cecile finally turned as she got to the glass doors and looked to see where we were. When we caught up, she said, "Y'all have to move if you're going to be with me." "Fern needs help," I told her. Then Fern said, "I do not." And Vonetta said, "I need help." Cecile's face had no expression. She swooped down, grabbed Fern's bag handle, and said, "Y'all keep up." She started walking, the same wide steps as before. I took Fern's hand and we all followed. The gap wasn't as wide as when we first started out, but there was distance between Cecile and my sisters and me. Mobs easily threaded through and around us. You couldn't see we were together. There was something uncommon about Cecile. Eyes glommed onto her. Tall, dark brown woman in man's pants whose face was half hidden by a scarf, hat, and big dark shades. She was like a colored movie star. Tall, mysterious, and on the run. Mata Hari in the airport. Except there weren't any cameras or spies following the colored, broad-shouldered Mata Hari. Only three girls trailing her from a slight distance. We followed her outside, where green and white cabs lined up. Instead of going to the first cab in the line, Cecile ducked her head and searched every other cab. It was at the fourth cab that she bent down and rapped against the window. The driver, wearing a black beret, leaned over, nodded, unlocked the front door, and said something like, "Zilla," which I guess was short for Cecile in a colored Oakland way. Cecile opened the back door. "Come on." I asked, "Can't we put our bags in the..." "Girl, will you get in this car?" Vonetta and Fern stiffened. Big Ma could be hard. Papa didn't play around. But no one talked to me like that. It was just as Big Ma had said. We were in a boiling pot of trouble cooking. Still, there was no time to soothe my pride. I had to make everything all right for Vonetta and Fern so they'd fall in line. I got in first with my bag, pulling Fern in with me while she held on to Miss Patty Cake, and then Vonetta got in with her bag. Cecile and the cab driver lit up cigarettes as we drove on. At least Papa doesn't smoke his viceroys in the Wildcat. Vonetta coughed, and Fern looked green. I didn't bother to ask what I could and could not do. I cranked down my window to let the air in. We were quiet, riding along, gazing out the windows at Oakland and stealing looks at Cecile. Before I could get a thought going about Cecile or Oakland, the cab driver led us out not too far from the airport. "You live near the airport?" Vonetta asked. Cecile didn't answer. She just said, "Come on." As we walked, she hid deeper into her hat and shades, like she didn't want anyone to see her with us. Was she ashamed she had three girls she'd left behind and had to explain? "Who are these girls? Yours? Why don't they live with you?" "Don't expect no pity from us. We were asked the same questions in Brooklyn. Where's your mother? Why don't she live with you? Is it true she died?" Cecile placed Fern's suitcase on the bench of a bus stop and sat down. "Why are we taking the bus?" Vonetta asked. "Why didn't the cab take us?" I shushed Vonetta just to keep Cecile from saying something mean. By my timex, the bus came in 4 minutes. Cecile made us get on first and said, "Go all the way to the back and sit down." When we found seats, Cecile was still with the bus driver arguing with him. 10 and under ride for free, she said. "Now give me 4 transfers." I'd been 11 for a good while, standing tall, but I said to Vonetta and Fern, "If anyone asks, I'm 10. Vonetta folded her arms. "Well, I'm still 9. I'm not going back to 8. Fern said, "I'm staying 7. I hushed them both down. A lot of good it did if the bus driver heard us getting our ages straight. Tell the truth, it was Cecile I was worried about, not the driver. We didn't have to stay with the bus driver for the next 28 days. We had to stay with Cecile. Green Stucco House. Big Ma said Cecile lived on the street. The park bench was her bed. She lived in a hole in the wall. You can't say stuff like that to a kid asking about her mother when it's snowing outside or pouring down raining. You can't say, "Your mother lives on the street in a hole in the wall, sleeping on park benches next to winos." I didn't understand expressions when I was 6. But they were strings of words spoken so often the string fell slack. "Your mother lives on the street in a hole in the wall, sleeping on park benches next to winos." Sounded exactly as Big Ma said it. When you're 6, you picture your mother living on black and gray tar full of potholes, broken glass, skid marks, and blackened gum, all of that overrun by cars, buses, and trucks. You squeeze your brain one way, your imagination the other way, and see your mother peeking out of the holes of crumbling abandoned buildings to stay dry when it snowed or rained. You see your mother sleeping on splintery park benches stained with pigeon poop and a smelly, toothless wino sleeping next to her. When you're 6, you wonder why your mother would rather live on the street, in a hole in the wall, and sleep on park benches next to winos than live with you. Even though I'd finally figured out these were expressions and not the plain, factual truth, I expected Cecile Johnson to, at the very least, be bad off. To be one of those Negroes living in poverty, as the news often put it. I expected I'd have to nudge Vonetta and Fern into knowing better when they asked for all the things we had at home, like Mr. Bubble Bubble Bath, extra helpings of chicken and ham, or banana pudding on Sundays. When Cecile slowed her man-sized steps, tore off her big hat, her scarf, and her dark glasses, we knew we had arrived. We followed her into the yard and down the walkway. I stared at her 8 thick braids of unpressed hair, pencil shoved in the plait above her ear. Then I joined my sisters, taken in the shock of her house and yard. The place where she lived.
"This your house?"
Vonetta was the first to put our amazement into words. To begin with, the house was covered in peaks of hard green frosting. Stucco, Cecile called it. She said she applied the stucco herself. The green prickly house was surrounded by a dried out but neatly trimmed lawn. To one side of the house was a rectangular concrete slab with a roof over it. A carport, she said. Just no car. On the other side, a baby palm tree sloped toward the sun. That palm tree was as out of place as the stucco. That's how I could be sure it was Cecile's home, all right. Even though Cecile said the house was hers and not to worry about how she got it, that wasn't enough to suit Vonetta. Big Ma said, I kicked it before she could go further. She knew better than to repeat Big Ma's words, and if she didn't, that kick should have smarted her into knowing better. Whether Cecile heard Vonetta starting to insult her or if she saw me kick her second child, she didn't let on. She just said, come on, and put the key in the door. We walked inside and looked around. I expected to see writing on the walls, wavy colored hippie writing all over, since she was free to do what she wanted in her own house. I expected to read strings and strings of words tapped out from her pencil onto the walls. But the walls in Cecile's house were clean, painted a yellow beige, and had no writing. Still, flashes of memory popped before me. Flashes of Cecile writing on the walls, and on boxes. Flashes of paint smells. Papa painting over her pencil marks. Flashes of loud Papa and Cecile, angry talking. When I'd asked about it, Uncle Darnell had said they'd fought over Cecile writing on the walls all the time. Your room's in the back, bathroom across the hall. The day bed rolls out. That should be enough for all y'all. Fern folded her arms, holding Miss Patty Cake by a tuft of her patchy yellow hair.
We need night beds. We sleep at night.
I could tell Cecile didn't know whether to be annoyed or amused. She looked at all of us, wondering not only who we were, but what we were. Fern didn't notice the scrutiny. She turned to me.
I don't nap in the daytime. I'm in the second grade.
Never to be outdone, Vonetta said. I'm in the fourth grade. Cecile said, I didn't ask for all that. As I expected, Vonetta's feelings got hurt because she was always sticking herself on stage for everyone to see her. Still, Vonetta hadn't been kicked enough. She whirled around in the living room like a dance recital fairy. Whirled around on her heels, taking in the clean walls, the curtains, a beat-up sofa, a few stacks of books, and not much else. Landed and said, Where's the TV and everything? Vonetta was too far from me to nudge or kick. Cecile dropped Fern's bag on the floor and started muttering.
I didn't send for you. Didn't want you in the first place. Should have gone to Mexico to get rid of you when I had the chance.
It didn't seem like she was talking to us. She didn't even look at Vonetta or Fern and me. She kept talking, muttering about Mexico, throwing her Matahari disguise on the beat-up sofa. Our mother wore pencils in her hair, dressed like a secret agent, had a stickly, prickly house, a palm tree when no one else had one, and clean painted walls instead of the writing I remembered. Now I got why our mother ran away. Our mother was crazy. Come on, I said. Let's see the room. Put our stuff away. Vonetta and Fern raced down the hall, pushing to be first. Cecile yelled after them, but they were too excited to hear her. I came in after them. A bed with a brass headboard and armrails, a blue cover. A dresser. A goosenecked floor lamp with a glass bowl in the shape of a half moon. It was more furniture than she had in the living room. We can't all fit on this one bed, Vonetta said. I raised up the blue cover and found the other bed underneath. Come on, help me pull it out. We all latched on and pulled. The bed rolled out into a stair step of one bed below and another above. I said, she should have helped us.
Surely should have, Fern said.
I sleep on top, Vanetta called.
No, I sleep on top.
Fern did her best Rocky the Flying Squirrel leap, arms outstretched to belly onto the bed. Vanetta followed, and they wrapped into wrestling. I let them. They hadn't had a good fight all day. After 6.5 hours on the plane and keeping up with Cecile, I figured they could use the recreation. They took turns getting the best of each other. But just before crying time set in, I pulled one off the other and said, "You both sleep on top. There's enough room."
"Why do you get a bed all to yourself?" Vanetta cried. "You're not that big that you need a bed all to yourself."
I was big enough to give up a full view of the world on the 727, and big enough to outsmart my sisters at every turn.
"You can come down here with me," I said, scooting over so I wasn't claiming the whole bed.
"I don't care."
"I'm staying on top," Vanetta said.
"Me too."
We looked around in silence at the walls, the dresser, the goose-necked floor lamp with its half-moon glass bowl. It certainly wasn't much.
Vanetta wanted to say something. She had that look.
"Spit it out, Vanetta," I said.
"Yeah, spit it,"
Fern said.
Vanetta cut her eyes toward Fern.
To me, she said, "Delphine, what we got to do with Mexico?"
That one had also thrown me when Cecile said it.
"Should have gone to Mexico to get rid of you when I had the chance."
I didn't rightfully know what that meant, but I was all my sisters had, so I said, "That's where women go who don't want their babies."
"But why Mexico?"
"And not Queens?" Fern asked.
"Because Queens is too close," I said as if I knew. Then I added, showing all of my age and wisdom,
"They buy babies down in Mexico for rich people."
They both said, "Oh."
I didn't want to say Big Ma was right. Cecile was no kind of mother. Cecile didn't want us. Cecile was crazy.
I didn't have to.
Mean Lady Ming. We stood as one, looking up at her. Me in the front, Vanetta and Fern at my sides. She was tall and broad-shouldered, where Pa was just tall. As hungry as I was, all I could think was that they made you dance with a boy in the 6th grade, that I would never look right dancing with a boy, and for that I had Cecile to thank. I spoke first.
"We're hungry."
As usual, my sister's voices followed on top of mine.
Vanetta, "What's for supper?"
Then Fern.
"Hungry, hungry," she rubbed her belly.
We made a picture. Us looking up at her and her looking down at us. In the animal kingdom, the mother bird brings back all she's gathered for the day and drops it into the open mouths of each bird, squawking to be fed. Cecile looked at us like it didn't occur to her that we would be hungry and she'd have to do what mothers do, feed their young. I'm no Big Ma in the kitchen, but I would have opened a can of beans and fried up some franks. I can bake a chicken and boil potatoes. I would have never let my long-gone daughters travel nearly 3,000 miles without turning on the stove.
She said, "What you want from me?"
"Supper," I answered. "It's past 8 o'clock. We haven't had real food since breakfast."
"With Big Ma."
"And Papa," I kept going. "That was," I glanced at my wrist, 9 hours and 12 minutes ago.
Vanetta next. "Airline food don't count."
Fern last. "Surely don't."
She was still looking down at us as if we'd thrown a monkey wrench into her quiet Tuesday evening. Then she spoke.
"Where's the money your father gave you?"
I crossed my arms. There was no way she was getting our money.
"That money's for Disneyland," I told her.
"To go on all the rides.
And meet Tinkerbell."
This was the first time we heard Cecile laugh, and she laughed like the crazy mother she was turning out to be.
"Is Tinkerbell going to feed you?"
She was still laughing. We didn't think she was funny. We said nothing rather than talk back and get slapped.
Look, she said, if you want to eat, hand over the money.
I stared her down, something I'd never try with Big Ma. Cecile didn't seem to care. She said,
fine, I got plenty of air sandwiches here. Go on back to the room, open your mouths and catch one.
The stare down ended right there. I unlaced my right tennis shoe, wriggled my foot out, and removed the mound of tens and twenties Pa had given me. Cecile didn't care that the money had been baking under my foot since we left Brooklyn. She took the money, unfolded and counted the bills, then stuffed them in her pants pocket except for a $10 bill, which she held out to me.
Go round the corner to Ming's. Order a large shrimp lo mein. She counted our heads as if she didn't know how many of us she had. 4 egg rolls and a big bottle of Pepsi.
Vonetta and Fern squealed for the shrimp and Pepsi, forgetting that this was wrong. Our mother should have cooked real food for us. At the very least, baked a chicken. Made franks and beans.
Fruit punch, I said. Big Ma don't allow us to have strong drinks.
Cecile let out a single whoop of a laugh. Vonetta and Fern were too excited about having takeout to see that our mother was crazy. I said, we have to call Pa. Let him know we arrived. They chimed in.
Safe and sound.
On the ground.
Cecile said, phone's next to Ming's.
You mean you don't have a phone?
Vonetta asked. Cecile said,
I don't have no one to call, and I don't want no one calling me.
Whether Cecile had a phone was not my main worry. We have to go out after 8 to call Pa and get the food. Aren't you coming with us?
Ming's is a couple of blocks down Magnolia, around the corner. She pointed the direction. Phone booth's right there.
When we were barely out the door, she added,
and tell Ming to give you 4 plates, 4 forks, 4 napkins, and 4 paper cups. No sense dirtying dishes. And you're not coming inside my kitchen.
We all looked at one another and thought the same thing.
Crazy.
I led the way in the direction Cecile pointed. Down the walk, past the slumping palm tree, made a right turn. Vonetta and Fern, as usual, nipped the heels of my tennis shoes. It wasn't dark at all, but it wasn't high daylight either. Kids of all ages still ran around playing in yards and riding bikes on the street. I bet kids ran around and played out here all year long, and not only in the summer. We usually went to the summer camp at the Y or drove down to Alabama in Papa's Wildcat. We came upon some kids playing freeze tag. They jumped from lively wiggle worms to frozen statues just as we neared their yard. We felt the smirks of the gaping statues on us. Vonetta smiled, welcoming their interest in us. She was scouting out new friends to be with for the next 28 days. I let her lag a step or two behind to wink and smile at them. You can't stop Vonetta from chasing after friends. I kept walking, Fern sticking close to me. Vonetta skipped until she caught up. One thing was for sure. These blocks might have been long like the blocks on Herkimer Street, but we were far from Brooklyn. I didn't know where any of these streets led, but I walked down Magnolia like I knew where I was going. I couldn't help but notice that not one yard had a palm tree. Not one. Or stucco. Not one house was painted that crazy green color. I was thinking this wind behind us crept a rumbling against concrete, like a barrel rolling, the rolling broken by the cracks in the sidewalk. I turned. A voice yelled,
"Gangway!"
We tried to jump aside, but the three of us jumping all together only got us so far. A boy on top of a wooden board, this flying T with tricycle wheels in the back, rumbled by and managed to clip me good.
Hey, watch out,
I called after him, shaking my fist. He only stopped at the corner to pick up his flying tee, carry it across the street, and lay it back down on the sidewalk.
Sorry,
he yelled without turning around. Then he gave it a running push and jumped on it, eventually lying stomach down, his arms outstretched as he held on to both ends of the tee.
"What was that?" Bonetta asked.
"Some stupid boy," I said. "Come on, y'all." I had to pull Vonetta's chin away from the direction of the boy on the flying tee. She kept looking even after he was long gone. Ming's was where Cecile said it was, around the corner and a couple blocks down. There was a big sign, Ming's, and underneath it, red neon characters that looked like fighting men waving swords. The telephone booth was also where Cecile said it would be, right next to Ming's. I planned on calling Pa before getting the food, but the booth was already occupied by a light-skinned guy with a big floppy afro. He was turned sideways, but I could see his profile, his beakish nose, the way he pushed his head this way and that suspiciously while he talked. We stood with our arms folded, waiting for him to finish. He looked like a fugitive from justice.